Good evening. Tonight we have Ruth Marcus from the Washington Post, who writes in the editorial page and who has worked elsewhere in the newspaper. She's covered the White House and covered the Supreme Court and written about campaign financing. So she has a broad view of the journalism world within that newspaper, how things work. And tonight we're going to talk to her about several things. About the editorial page, but we'll also talk about covering the White House and how things are similar, how things have changed, and covering the court as well. Welcome, Ruth.
Thank you.
Glad to have you. I wonder if you can tell us something about how the editorial page works. It's one of those processes in a newspaper that just seems to be behind the veil, kind of like the court.
Only slightly less secretive. Hopefully we produce our work a little more quickly than the court does sometimes. I can't speak to other editorial pages, but our page meets in the morning, usually about four times a week, on the days we don't meet.
How many people are involved?
There are about eight of us who write editorials, and the editor of the page, Fred Hyatt. And we all have particular areas of kind of subject matter expertise, mm-hmm. though they blend into each other. And the truth is that is such a small number of people to cover such a large zone, mm-hmm. because that includes not just national issues, but international issues and our local political issues, yeah. And other local issues in the area. So there are two folks who cover mostly local issues. There's somebody who writes about foreign policy. There's somebody who writes about a combination of foreign and policy and economic issues. And then there are two of us who write on domestic issues, and I write a lot about budget and taxes and politics. And we start the morning by going around the table.
When do you start?
We start around 10:30, but uh-huh. by that point, you really right. have to pretty much come in every morning knowing what it is you want to do and hopefully having gotten a reasonable start on it.
But what would you read in the morning before you come in?
I read the Post and the Times and the Wall Street Journal, and then I tend to look at some of the websites that uh-huh. kind of combine some of the news. Like National Journal does something called Early Bird, and I look at that because that gives me a distillation of what's on the other editorial pages, what's in news stories, and usually what I write about isn't so much from that morning's newspaper, but every once in a while there's something that you didn't know was coming that you have to leap on right away. So we come in and gather around a big conference table around 10:30, and we go around the table, and each one of us talks about what we're planning to write about for that day. And though obviously we run pretty much usually three editorials a day, so not everybody produces an editorial every single day, but we kind of store them up like nuts for the winter because we uh-huh. need them for the weekend also. And people will ask questions about, you know, what position are you taking? Does this make sense? Have you considered this issue? Or I have a good person for you to call. There'll be issues that we aren't all in agreement about, and some of those conversations will take longer. I find if you say that I'm writing about pensions, you can usually get a very quick pass because no one will write. But then we all kind of go back to our offices and make a lot more phone calls than people realize, uh-huh. I would say, because you sometimes you know enough about a subject that you can just sit down and write about it, but almost always it requires you to talk to the people involved to get a sense of where things are heading and what's going on behind the scenes and what more you need to know that the reporters on your newspaper probably knew but didn't have enough space to get into the paper.
Uh-huh. Now, when you're deciding the three editorials, what kind of blend is there? Like, you wouldn't do three national politics.
Well, I would.
Probably.
I might choose to do that if I were running things. No, what is running the next day isn't really decided until about this time at night, around 6 or 6:30 uh-huh. at night. And usually and optimally, there'll be a blend of one thing involving a national issue, one editorial involving a local issue, either in Maryland or the District of Virginia, and one foreign policy, international mm-hmm. affairs question. That's pretty much the most balanced way that the page comes out. But it also literally is a matter sometimes of fitting in jigsaw puzzle pieces. So sure. because we have a set number of column inches, then they all have to add up.
Uh-huh. And how do you decide which one, which order they go in?
The editorial page editor decides that, mm-hmm. and I think it's largely on the issue of sort of what he wants to make the biggest statement with.
Mm-hmm. And so that's his call.
That's his call.
There's never any voting that's done or anything like that by the group as a whole?
No, we never have a kind of formal vote on anything. Uh-huh. But I wrote something today that I wanted one of my colleagues to take a special look at because she happens to have a particular expertise in a few of the things I was mentioning. And we're all invited to, and it's good if we do, read our colleagues' editorials before they go into the paper. So if there's something that somebody has written, for example, I don't write about legal issues, one of my colleagues does, but I have a lot of background in writing about legal issues and judges, and I care a lot about that. And so we'll go back and forth, and I'll say, I don't like this sentence, and we try to accommodate each other. And in that sense, that's actually a strange uh-huh. way in which it is like a court.
So after you've decided what you want to write about, then how do you decide where you can get your information? Have you already gotten the information together before writing on it, or do you kind of start from there?
Well, you build up expertise in different subject areas over time, and it sort of depends on the issue, but I would say I do a lot more report reading, really boring report reading than uh-huh. I did when I was a reporter, because one of the things that, and I really loved being a reporter, but one of the things that was a little bit more, not easier, but a little less pressured as a reporter was your job was to pretty much distill the best arguments from each side. This is this side's argument, this is this side's argument. Now I have to really, really, really think the issue through so that I know and can say on behalf of the Washington Post and with the help of my colleagues who has the better of the argument. And that takes it's a little more stressful and a lot more kind of labor intensive. So my boss says it's like reporting a 40-inch story, but then you have to condense it into less than 10 inches.
Uh-huh. Are the styles different of the writers?
Of each of us internally?
Yes, right, so that there doesn't have to be kind of one set style for a post editorial.
There is an editorial voice. I find that I sound different to me when I write an editorial as opposed to when I write a column, and there is that we thing that goes on. Uh-huh. We believe, blah, blah, blah. Uh-huh. But I think that within that kind of general sense of you don't want to be, you're writing for an institution, and so you don't want to be overly flip about things, but you can tell, I can tell mm-hmm. from the outside, not just based on subject matter, but also a little bit on tone, who's writing what mm-hmm. editorial, but I'm not sure anybody else can from the yeah. outside, but we do sound different.
Uh-huh. Because, for example, you use quotes.
I use a lot of quotes.
And so that's something of a tip-off of yours.
I use a lot of quotes. It's funny, I wrote something that was in this morning's paper where I realized I was using a phrase that one of my fellow editorial writers uses that's not usually uh-huh. a phrase of mine. But I really, 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 and it's logical based on my history, I'm a big believer in quotes. A lot of times mm-hmm. I use them and then have to cut them for space. But they're very convincing to me to have, especially if you're quoting someone who is now saying something different, or mm-hmm. you know, an argument uh-huh. that is now being used by the other side. And or a lot of times, and it's fun to do, which we never do in news stories, to lead with a quote and to use that as the sort of mm-hmm. Jumping off point for an issue that you want to discuss. But yes, you've found my trademark.
Now, you had a signed piece on the op-ed page not so long ago that dealt with Larry Summers. Mm-hmm. How would you choose to do that rather than to have it as an editorial? And was there any discussion about Larry Summers?
I think everybody in America has talked about Larry Summers. My 7-year-old asked me about him the other day. Who's that guy who says girls aren't smart? And she said, well, is he losing his job? And I said, I don't know. It's still up in the air. And she said, well, I think he shouldn't, because it was his opinion. And I thought that was uh-huh. very, very nice. Larry Summers, I actually thought, was a time when it made sense for me to write under my own name, because honestly, if you're the editorial page of the Washington Post and you're writing an editorial about Larry Summers, and you know it is such a complicated and divisive issue, and we eventually did actually run an editorial mm-hmm. about Larry Summers, but you can't say, but I knew I was taking a position that was going to be somewhat controversial,
right. uh-huh.
which was that, yes, Larry Summers is compulsively in politic, but really, why is he being, well, this was before the substance of his statements came out, or the exact text of his
right.
statements.
Yeah.
Why is he being pilloried for raising this question, and which is as part of a discussion of this. I actually thought it was probably better for the Post to have that discussion under the name initially of somebody who happened to be a woman, and mm-hmm. rather than expose the page really to uh-huh. criticism of just being insensitive and sexist and everything, because you can't really say in the editorial, by the way, written
yeah.
by a woman.
Right, yeah. Are there issues that come up like that that the group then says that, well, maybe it'd be better for somebody to write that under their own name?
Every once in a while, though, we are part of a collective group, and if you dissent from a particular issue, mm-hmm. it's probably better to keep that internal. But there are some times where you might be a little bit ahead of the crowd or mm-hmm. differently from the crowd, but not necessarily disagreeing, where it might make sense.
Mm-hmm. How long do you all meet?
It sort of depends on whether we're talking about pensions or whether we're talking uh-huh. about, you know, steroids and baseball or something more, which we haven't really talked about yet, something more fun. But it generally takes about an hour.
Uh-huh.
To get around the table and have everybody talk about what they're going to do.
Uh-huh. And then what do you do after that?
Research.
Uh-huh.
Either reading or picking up the phone and calling people. We also have often people who come in, either in the this morning we had Roy Blunt from the House
mm-hmm.
come in and talk to both us and the news side, but it was put together by the editorial page, and that was very interesting. We had that before our meeting, but a lot of times people will come in the afternoon to talk about mm-hmm. various issues. And I do what I did when I was a reporter. I make a lot of phone calls, talk to people, and then start writing, usually around 3 or so.
Huh. When you have people come in, is that related to a particular editorial, or is it just that you want to inform yourselves on an area that this person might be important in?
Well, it's generally not related to a particular, well, it could be related to a particular editorial.
Right.
For example, if a big commission is coming out with a report and wants to get it some attention, maybe they'll call up and say, can we come in to talk about, I don't know, oceans or environmental policy or civil service reform or something, some other totally thrilling topic.
What about
topic.
The 9/11 Commission?
Or something like that. And so we'll have a conversation about that. Or sometimes it's to educate us about a topic. For example, we've had a number of people come in to talk about Social Security, which has some diminishing returns at some point because you have heard a lot of the arguments. Right. But we've had AARP, we've had proponents of various forms of private accounts. We've had AEI and Heritage together. Uh-huh. So we've really heard a lot from all sides on that, and hopefully it's informed our editorials.
How often do you have those kinds of sessions?
It's not kind of mandatory attendance, mm-hmm. so that people who have particular, a delegation from a particular country will come in, or a particular group, an environmental group, or a particular local legislator will come in. I would say probably two or three of those a week.
Hmm. Before the baseball deal, or around the whole baseball deal, did you have those kinds of sessions?
We did.
Was it high attendance?
High attendance. Some people, I am not a big baseball person, but a lot of people cared about it a lot more than I did.
So do people from, the sports section?
Well, some people want to talk just to the editorial board.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes they want to do it not for the record, but just to inform us. And sometimes people want a wider array of people there. And so we very much try to accommodate our friends from the newsroom.
Mm-hmm.
And they accommodate us at some of their events. And so,
yeah.
For example, Congressman Blunt this morning was a joint newsroom editorial page.
Uh-huh.
Event. And
do you have former presidents? Do you have any? Have you had any presidents?
We have not, not since I've been there, and I've been doing it for about 2+ years now.
Uh-huh. Candidates?
A lot of candidates.
Uh-huh.
We had, we saw pretty much everybody at some point during the campaign, except on the Democratic side.
Mm-hmm.
The Republican nominee didn't,
uh-huh.
didn't feel the need to come in.
Yeah. Then in the afternoon, what time do you have to have it finished?
We have way earlier deadlines than the news side.
Yeah.
That was probably the biggest shock to me, because at 6:30 in the newsroom, you're just kind of loosening your fingers up and getting things going. We pretty much, a lot of things are sitting in the assignment basket waiting to be plucked out and find their space on the page, and a lot of times they've been circling for a while and waiting for a landing spot. Sometimes there's nothing in the assignment basket and they go right in, and sometimes there'll be days when, for example, I wrote something about the bankruptcy bill, and that took a long, long time to study the bill and figure out what to think about it. And that's more than a day of thinking. That's a couple days of talking to people and reading a lot of pretty dreary things. But when I'm writing a daily piece, I'll start writing, about 3:30, 4 o'clock, and I'll pretty much be done by 5:30 or 6, depending on kind of how it's going.
Yes, that's a good cycle for your day.
Yeah.
To have that. How long do people stay on it? Did they try to cycle through most a lot of people
that were there on the editorial page?
Yeah.
I think it's a kind of, in the newsroom, if you have a beat, generally, unless you very much want to specialize in that area, you'll generally cycle through your beat in 3 or 4 years. For example, if you're in a foreign posting, you're not going to. It's pretty much a rule, you're going to stay there for 3 or 4 years and then you'll go do something else. The editorial page, it's only been fairly recently that we've had folks come in from the newsroom.
Uh-huh.
And so the cycling back to the newsroom is has only happened once that I'm thinking of. And so because we've all expressed opinions about a lot of things, and
uh-huh.
and so where precisely you go next. And plus it's a, you know, it's an extraordinarily interesting life. Uh-huh. Actually, we've had two people cycle back to the newsroom
uh-huh.
That I can think of. But there's not a lot of desire to find something different to do.
Uh-huh. What kind of impact do you look for on the on editorials?
Well, I think there's sort of two different versions of impact, and I think that's a wonderful question. One is just, and this has been a big piece of what I've cared about with Social Security, is simply a public education impact.
Mm-hmm.
One, to me, one role of an editorial is to give people a framework for thinking about an issue and give them enough information to help make a decision on their own. The other is, but sometimes you want to have a much more oomphy kind
uh-huh.
of impact, which is to say, for example, we had an editorial in the paper this morning about the impasse that's going on at the Ethics Committee.
Mm-hmm.
The five Democrats on the Ethics Committee have refused to go along with the rules of the that the Republican majority, not on the committee because that's an evenly split
right.
committee, but that the Republican majority in the House imposed. We took a very clear side on that, said this was a fairly extraordinary thing to do, which is they pretty much shut down the ethics process. But we said in our last line of the editorial, we would like to see more Republicans sign on to this effort and come up with a more bipartisan ethics package. So whether the result that we would love to see would be to
uh-huh.
See that happen, whether we're going to have that intended result, I'm a lot more skeptical
uh-huh.
about. And a lot of times we are writing for two audiences. One is a sort of general audience, here's how you might want to think about this issue. A lot of times when that issue has already passed and so there's nothing that can be done about it, we're just fomenting. But sometimes you are writing in a way that would never occur to you as a on the news side to influence the debate,
mm-hmm.
to say, hey, wait, before you do this, stop and think about this question. Think about this amendment. Fix the rules about X, Y, or Z.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, every once in a while it happens, and that's pretty rewarding.
Yeah. Do you ever see how the editorial gets into the debate? Like, for example, the floor debate in the House
yeah.
and the Senate, and the editorials come up.
I've had just, you know, sort of out-of-body experience of sitting in my office doing my work, fielding calls from my kids about, you know, where their homework is or why can't they watch TV, and listening to some member of Congress read this editorial that I had managed to dash off
yeah.
the day before. And that's and you know that's going to happen. I mean, you know
uh-huh.
when you write it that it's not that you write an editorial and therefore it has this impact. You know you're going to write an editorial and it is going to be seized on by
yeah.
one side or the other.
Uh-huh.
A lot of times it will be Republicans saying, oh, look, the liberal Washington Post. Well, we're not actually the liberal Washington Post if you read the editorial page carefully, but that's obviously our image
yeah.
in the world. And so they whenever our editorial page does agree with something that they've been arguing, which is not at all uncommon, you know, that will be their sort of perfect, you know, even the Washington Post says X, Y, or Z, and
yeah.
you sort of see it blown up.
Uh-huh. What about candidates? What impact and under what circumstances does an editorial page, do you think, make a difference?
Well, you know, the most obvious one is endorsements.
Uh-huh.
We have not tended to endorse presidential candidates in primaries.
Mm-hmm.
We did, though we considered it this time around. But we wrote a lot of editorial assessments of candidates, which uh-huh. was the alternative that we thought was helpful for people. And sort of said, oh, this is what we like, this is what we don't like. So I think it affects candidates in, obviously, they're all wanting our endorsement in the end, local candidates much more, yeah. obviously, than national candidates. And also, I think that we are a voice that tries to bring some sense of kind of honesty and accountability to the debate on both sides, so that during the presidential campaign, we took pretty much everybody to task at some point for mm-hmm. saying things that we thought were irresponsible, like you can't cut Social Security benefits ever, completely untouchable, or things that were unfair. We weighed in mm-hmm. Very much on the against the Swift Boat ads as a uh-huh. below-the-belt attack. And that was used, obviously, the campaign obviously picked that up and sent right. it around. And, you know, we would have this hysterical moments during the primaries when one day one of the campaigns would be just calling and yelling about something we had written, and this was so terrible. And, of course, the next day they would be sending around our editorial.
Yeah.
So that seemed like pretty good deal to me.
When you're doing election covers, like say well before the election year begins, is there ever any discussion about how the coverage is going to work, not just the newsroom, but the editorial page, and using the editorial page to inform people? Is there any time when kind of everybody gets together?
Newsroom and editorial?
Yeah, right.
Only in the context of interviewing candidates mm-hmm. and making sure, you know, with certain candidates, you know you're only going to get one bite at the apple, one yeah, chance for right. an interview. And you don't want to be, we all have different, there's a little bit of competition right. there,
sure.
and you don't want to either disadvantage yourselves or disadvantage your newsroom, and these are my former colleagues, and mm-hmm. We want to work together in that way. We absolutely do not discuss anything about the substance of the coverage. That would mm-hmm. completely violate our sense of separation of church and state, and mm-hmm. we could be at the same interview, and then we just go our separate ways and do our separate things.
Mm-hmm.
We do internally on the page talk about what our role in the campaign mm-hmm. is, what we, for example, during this last campaign, which was my first one on the other side
right.
of
yeah.
the wall, in church, as we say, we did two things. We did these sort of series of candidate, well, three things. We did kind of welcome to the race pieces when everybody uh-huh. formally announced their candidacy or their intention to run. That sort of summed up what our impressions were of them at that point, and welcome. But we tried to be nice to everybody mm-hmm. a little bit. It was for some candidates, it was easier than others.
Uh-huh.
I'm not sure we were that nice to Ralph Nader when he entered. Then we did a bunch of issues pieces. That was particularly at the end of the campaign when it was down to the uh-huh. two nominees. But we did the environment, we did Social Security, we did foreign affairs, we did Iraq, we did a whole slew of specific issues. Then we did these assessments of the primary candidates, and then we did a lot of episodic pieces
uh-huh.
as the news was generated. We wrote after every debate mm-hmm. and things like that, and we wrote at the conventions almost every day.
Mm-hmm.
So,
do you ever have, does the White House ever call? I mean, the White House might call reporters. Do they ever call the editorial page?
They do not often call me. I've been surprised, actually,
uh-huh.
about how little contact we have. There are some issues on which they've reached out and said, well, we want to talk about this. But on the issues that I write about, it's been not mm-hmm. not as much give and take as actually I would like.
Would they send people? Would they suggest that they'd like to have somebody come and talk, like a national security person, mm-hmm. like say in the first term, Condi?
They do some of that. They're very they very much like to do those things as they do at the White House on background.
Well, speaking of the White House, you covered the White House, but it was an earlier time. What do you see today as a difference from the White House when you covered it, and in terms of technology, everything, not just their media practices, but if you were a reporter day covering the White House, how is that different from the time that when you were there?
Well, I think that. In one sense, the advent of email would make it better and more accessible because everyone is so basically welded to their BlackBerries on both sides of the transaction that make life even better than in the age of only cell phones. And so I think in that sense, covering the White House is probably a little bit easier now because you know you can pretty much at least make sure you get a message to someone at any time, and it's easier for them to get back to you. Other than that, and you have the sort of, you know, instantaneous internet transmission of transcripts and things like that that just happen to make, like all technology, I think, life a little bit easier for reporters. You can... Though I did actually used to think when I was covering the White House that I really wanted to do the experiment of, you know, kind of staying in bed and covering it in my pajamas for a week. Because, you know, you could get it on C-SPAN and everything then. This crowd strikes me as a lot less fun to cover than the Clinton administration, which might not have felt like fun at the time, but it was a tumultuous couple years. I covered the first 2 years of the Clinton administration, and it was just sort of, well, kind of one fiasco after another. This is a much more disciplined, I mean, you've heard it a million times, much more disciplined on-message crowd, and that just has to be a lot less fun for my colleagues.
Yeah, well, they had, when they came in, to start off with the Clinton administration, the senior aides, except for McLarty, the chief of staff, the senior aides were appointed 5 days before the inauguration. And so it certainly didn't give them any time to organize anything, and which they clearly had not.
Yeah.
So it was difficult to really get a handle on where they were going, whereas in this administration, they had already practiced senior staff meetings. Even though theirs was a truncated transition, they still managed to set things out somewhat beforehand. To what extent do you think, last week with Dan Bartlett and Mike McCurry, we were talking about differences in Democrats and Republicans. And one difference we did not discuss, but one that I think is kind of interesting to look at, is that when Democrats come in, that it looks like it's chaotic because the president sees a lot of people. He's trying to get information from all over. I remember a picture of Clinton who was working with a speech, and there were at least 13 people in the room, and which pretty much symbolized how that worked. But both Carter and Clinton came in after long periods of Republican rule, and in a sense, what they wanted to do is, come on, bring in all your ideas. Let's hear what are all the ideas. And then at a certain point, they're absolutely buried. And then the challenge is to kind of get out from under, which Clinton figured out how to do. And then they, you know, shifting from McLarty to Panetta, they certainly, you know, got a disciplined process. But Republicans...
If not a disciplined president.
yeah, that's right. Yeah, although the White House reflects a president. Yeah, it's a difficult discipline, I guess, only lasts so long and gets so deep. Yeah, but Republicans tend to be, you know, management, interested in management, so they come in with a tighter control. And they also don't want those same kinds of ideas. They already know what they want to talk about, so they don't want to generate ideas. Did you find any of those kinds of differences in looking at Democrats and Republicans as they begin, that in part the chaos was a kind of chaos that they wanted, that the president wanted?
Oh, I think so. There was a sort of whole element from the president on down, I think, during the beginning of the Clinton administration of government by all-nighter. And, you know, you remember the famous time when he started reading the wrong address because they were busy working on it in the car. And that was that happened to be, in particular, the way President Clinton liked to operate. But I think there is also something a little bit in the Democratic DNA that's a little less corporate and a little less hierarchical.
Yeah, that's true. And a lot of kind of interest group sorts of people, people who've been on the Hill. And you're right, it's far less hierarchical. What were, when you came in the Clinton administration, what were you looking for at the beginning of the administration?
I was thinking about, you know, it just, from the transition on, it just kept turning into story after story. First you had gays in the military, which was the gift that kept on giving for reporters. And you had Zoe Baird and nannies falling apart. And when after that finished falling apart, you had Lanny Guineer. And so you were really pretty much lurched. And then you had the travel office and the... You were kind of lurching with the administration from kind of one crisis to another, and I guess you were looking for, in a broader sense, how this was a president who for 2 years had a Democratic Congress, and what were his relations with that Congress going to be like, and how was he going to handle that compared to his Democratic predecessor. You had an extraordinarily interesting and uniquely powerful and involved First Lady, and that was a you know, continues to be a fascinating story.
What are the advantages of covering a White House, and what are the frustrations of it?
It's always struck me that being a White House reporter is one of those jobs that sounds like it's a lot more glamorous than it is. And I really vividly remember, and I was a very young reporter, going to the briefing room for the first time, not just as a gawker, sort of journalistic tourist, and I seeing all these kind of grumpy people. And I remember when my colleague Ann Devroy, who was our senior White House correspondent, brought me to the briefing room for the first time when I started covering the White House, and there were all these people just kind of hanging around and complaining, and it was the sort of waning days of the Bush one administration, and they were, the campaign was sort of off and running, and anybody who was left back at the White House didn't really have anything to do. But I thought I'd never seen a grumpier group, and I think a few years later I sort of understood the grumpiness. The White House, probably other than the Supreme Court, which is supposed to be that way, can be, even in the Clinton administration, even in an administration where people are more disposed than the current one to talk to the press, know people in the press, have pre-existing relationships, don't see the press as a kind of liberal, hostile force. If you compare, it seems to me that it's much more fun to be on the Hill, where you have huge numbers of people, members and staff, who want to do nothing more than talk to you and give you their point of view and tell you what they've heard from somebody else or about somebody else. Whereas the White House, and, you know, it's understood, yes, there are going to be factions, but fundamentally they're all serving one person, the president, and it's a much more kind of closed society. So I think that the fun of covering the White House, I suppose, is to pierce that every once in a while. But the frustration of covering the White House is how hard it is to pierce that.
What about the court? How do you gather information at the court?
Well, the thing, I covered the court for a few years before I covered the White House. And
what years did you cover?
I covered it from 1989 to 1992. And one of the things that happened during that time, one of the things that's sort of most fun for me about the court, because I like politics a lot, is we had nominations. So we had the well, we had the Souter nomination, and we had the Thomas nomination, and that was a real political brawl,
right,
and that was kind of regular reporting.
Yeah.
In terms of gathering information about the court, the thing I actually liked most about covering the court was getting out of Washington and going to see the people who had pretty much by chance and luck of the draw or whatever been caught up in Supreme Court cases. You know, everything from a bus driver in Nebraska who was accused of looking at child pornography, ordering child pornography on the internet. I almost killed myself driving to meet him in the middle of this blizzard. I was stranded for days out there. To interviewing a mentally retarded inmate on death row for another story. And it's those, that kind of, the court is, and it has to be to some extent, a closed off institution, and sometimes you can get behind those curtains there, but mostly the drama of the court to me is in the people that it affects, and the and the drama of people being named to it.
Mm-hmm. Do you find that that members of the court have been more public in recent years than they were at an earlier time? That they speak more, that they, you know, that they appear on television from time to time?
A little more public. I think it's that Justice Scalia and Justice Breyer just had this wonderful exchange in public about international law and the role of international law. And I think one of the greatest things that the court has done is to allow audio tape of some of its oral important oral arguments to become instantly available so that people can hear it. I mean, I think it's crazy and really a disappointment that the court is so dead set against having cameras in there. But the ability of the court to have audio is just a, and we've written actually a number of editorials about this, partly because I feel really, really strongly about it. It's just a, an enormous public service to be able to listen to those and have them available on C-SPAN and places like that to hear.
How do you gather information on cases? Because you don't know what cases are coming down when. I mean, you can have some idea because of when the oral argument was scheduled, but say all of a sudden there's going to be a decision that comes down, you don't know what it is. How do you prepare for it?
Well, you will have prepared it. If you're doing your job right, you will have prepared in advance. In other words, you probably have read something about the case even before the court took it, because there'll be a list of cases that are up to be granted a hearing at the court. Then once they're granted a hearing, if it's an important enough case, you'll have read the briefs, you'll have gone to the oral argument. And so hopefully by the time the case comes down, you'll know what you're dealing with. And that's not to say, it is a tough and scary job to be speed reading court opinions that law professors will then spend the next, you know, umpty-ump years arguing over and deciphering and interpreting, and you've got to sort of tell people what it meant in real time. My scariest story about this, if I could share it with you, was the night the Bush v. Gore decision came down. I was an editor on the national desk at the time, and I had been helping oversee our coverage of the post-election thing because I have this strange background. I went to law school once upon a time, so the whole post-election fight was the ultimate combination of politics and law, and so it was a exciting number of days that culminated, as you probably all remember, about 10 o'clock at night, right at our first edition deadline, and our Supreme Court reporter is at the court, and he's grabbed the opinion, and he's racing back, and we're all sort of just crashing on deadlines, speed reading, speed writing, and we wrote a lead that basically, and if you remember, the more you listened to television that night, the more confused you got. So I wrote a lead that said the Supreme Court did blah, blah, blah. effectively handing the presidency to George W. Bush. And uh-huh. my boss, the assistant managing editor for National News, said to me, Ruth, you know, this is a lot more definitive than the wires are saying right now. Are you sure that you're uh-huh. right here? And I just thought, oh, God, I've just watched my entire career disappear before my eyes. And, uh-huh. you know, what is the upside of saying, yes, I'm sure I'm right, go for it. Because uh-huh. if I'm wrong, you know, how uh-huh. are we going to explain it? Oh, we're really sorry, our lawyer, editor, former Supreme Court correspondent just blew it on deadline. But I actually did say, yes, I was sure I was right. And uh-huh. luckily, in fact, I was right. But it was probably yeah. my single scariest moment yeah. in journalism.
Well, what, in being right, kind of what who noticed? I mean, in a way, when mistakes occur, you know, everybody's there. But when you get it right, did you hear it from people in the paper?
Oh, I'm not anywhere near as much as I would have heard it if I had gotten it wrong.
Yeah.
And I knew that. But look, over time, if you have a solid understanding of something, whether it's a case, whether it's a controversy that's going on at the White House, whether it's a issue in a political campaign, if you sort of call it clearly and fairly and accurately, you know, no one is going to sort of give you official gold stars, but I do believe it sort of adds up and you get a reputation for uh-huh. better or for worse.
Yeah. What difference has it made to be a lawyer in all the kinds of coverage you had? Not just, you know, clearly it makes a difference in the Supreme Court, but what about some of the other areas that you've covered?
Well, I'm somebody who doesn't actually think that you need a law degree to write about law. I actually do very little writing about legal issues now. And in fact, our editorial writer who writes about legal issues, a guy named Ben Wittes, is not a lawyer mm-hmm. and knows so much more about law than I do at this point and is just absolutely brilliant about it. I do think it helps in two ways. One is that snobby lawyers tend to treat you less dismissively than they mm-hmm. might other reporters. I mean, I don't go and announce that I'm a lawyer, but if they're being really dismissive to me, uh-huh. I might mention that I might possibly understand them. And the second and more important part is that it probably just helps a little bit to understand an issue that touches on law a little more quickly. I loved writing about campaign finance.
Yeah.
And I think one of the reasons I was sort of kind of instinctively attuned to it, which is that it is really the intersection of law and politics. And I understood, mm-hmm. well, I never could understand when I was in law school tax law. Election law is a lot like tax law. It's sort of got a lot of rules, and you have to figure out, if you're an election lawyer, ways around them.
Yeah.
And if you're a reporter, you have to figure out how these people are figuring out ways around them.
Yeah, yeah. Because I remember that. I remember the coverage.
Yeah.
And it seemed that being a lawyer made a real difference.
It was really fun, and it was also right after I had been freed from the White House.
Uh-huh.
And I sort of felt like I... After having a lot of reporting that felt like sort of drudgery to me, you know, the president said yesterday, blah, blah, blah. This was in the days when actually hardly anybody was writing about campaign finance. It was before the big scandals of mm-hmm. The 1996 campaign. And so I had this huge field, not to myself, but with a lot of space to do a lot of kind of enterprising stories that other people weren't doing. And I liked that a lot.
When you're putting together a White House story, what are the basic elements of it? Like, say, the president makes an announcement, like, you know, he's doing something on Social Security, rather than just an event, say, in a policy. What are the elements that go in, and how do you decide where to put what, like what the president said, and where do you go for the other elements of a story?
Well, each one is probably different, but I guess the unifying theme is the president probably gets to go first. You know, here's what the president said, here's where he said it, here's the broader context of this campaign he's launching on XYZ, this is, you know, a piece of what he campaigned on, or this is a shift from a previous position, and, you know, here is the context of how it's apt to be received or being received on the Hill, and here's a response from the other party to it, and here's some things from his own party, and maybe here's a little bit of sort of what he's trying to achieve in terms of political benefit from it, and then, you know, probably towards the end, more of what I do as an editorial writer now, which is here's the argument about why it's a good idea, here's the argument about why it's a bad idea.
Well, let's go to the students and see if they've got any questions. Towson, do you have any questions?
You always got a question. What's the process for backing a candidate? Is it like an overall selection of the editorial writers, or is it more the publisher or the manager?
The process, it sort of depends on what level of candidate you're talking about. If it's a local candidate, like a school board election, we'll pretty much talk about it among ourselves, sometimes more intensively than others. With a presidential candidate, it's obviously an election we've been talking about for months, literally, and some of our views and some of the reasons we might like or dislike a particular candidate are already pretty well known. And then we tend to have a meeting that includes the whole editorial board run by the head of the editorial page. We'll have had some discussions with the publisher. And in the end, it's not a democracy, but it's not undemocratic either. Everybody sort of gets their say, and a decision happens. And I don't want to make it sound mysterious, but it sort of is that way.
Is the process, say, take a longer time the higher up you go?
Sure. And it should.
What about, because I could see that like the mayor, you know, an election is dealing with the mayor, is, you know, is high stakes in some ways. And even though it's not a national election, certainly it's important for the city.
I haven't been around for a mayoral election, but, I mean, if you just look at the space that we devote, and probably most of the other papers did as well, we devoted the entire column to our Kerry endorsement. And that bespoke pretty much the amount of attention we had paid to it, and everybody had paid to it. But there are, and in local races, our endorsement actually has a lot more impact.
Right.
And that's also taken very, very seriously.
Because in some ways, that the elections that maybe have the most impact are ones where the voters have the least information. And they're looking for cues. So we'll be kind of early in the process, like a primary. I can see where in a primary it would it could make a difference.
We don't tend to be involved in primaries because we're not either a Republican paper or a Democratic paper. But there have been times when we have gotten involved in primaries. Probably the best known one was in the primary in the Maryland congressional race, and that the seat that Chris Van Hollen has now. We endorsed Van Hollen in the primary, and then we endorsed Morella. This is before my time. Morella in the general.
Another question?
I have one. At
as you know, we've all been finishing these midterms here for Dr. Kumar's class.
Now, are they all in?
Yeah, they all in?
I have no idea what mine are. But one of the issues that, it's a general issue that I touched on.
Okay, can you try standing up to ask your question?
Project.
He's having a little trouble hearing.
One of the issues I had to discuss in doing these midterms was whether the news media really represents the people, the average, you know, American. And I was just wondering, you know, how do you feel about that? Does the Washington press really represent the concerns of the American people, or is it just an instrument just to give news to other Washington insiders and reporters and intellectuals?
For the surrogate of the people.
The question is whether, you could take the question two different ways. One is sort of who we're supposed to be serving in terms of providing information to, and the other one is whether we're kind of representative in a kind of demographic way of regular people out there. I mean, I think that as to the second one, I think all of the studies of the various surveys of the press corps have shown that we're not particularly representative, probably even of people in the Washington area, certainly not representative of the country as a whole. In terms of who we kind of think our target audience is, it's a little bit different on the editorial page than it is on the news side. I think on the news side, you absolutely know that you're writing for the reader, and you should be writing for the average reader and not for some kind of elite group. That's not to say that you expect every person out there to read your article tomorrow morning about the Senate taking up the budget resolution, but you still kind of hope they do. On the editorial page, because our role is explicitly to not just inform the public debate, but to influence it, I think we're much more consciously writing for a dual audience, both to help people shape and form their own opinions about the issues that are out there in the day, but also to have an impact on the decision makers. And so our audience, a piece of our audience, is much more kind of consciously the elite.
What about when you were covering the White House? Did you have an idea in mind of who you were writing for?
My mother.
Uh-huh.
No, I mean, you're writing to try to explain the functioning of this.
That's true.
Kind
of a lot of people.
Mysterious entity.
Almost everybody said that.
To people out there, and to try to bring some of the people who populate this kind of mystical entity to life, mm-hmm. and explain them.
Uh-huh.
Tell people something about the decision-making style of the White House, what goes on there, things like that. I don't think you're writing for, you're certainly not writing for the people inside. You know, there's also obviously an element of competition among all of us, and you're also writing to show that you can get an edge on your colleagues, that you've got, mm-hmm. you know, you can get the information first. There's a sort of, you know, mm-hmm. fun but silly competitive aspect to it also.
Mm-hmm. The White House thinks of, at least some people in the White House, Andy Card had said in an interview that the only people who represent the American people are those who are elected in Washington. But on the other side, you know, you have Helen Thomas saying that, you know, we are the surrogates for the public. Is that a kind of discussion that that people have, that reporters have? Is it a conscious kind of discussion that people have of kind of who your what your relationship is with the public?
I'm not sure it's very conscious. Mm-hmm. I do think that if you do this job and you get some, you know, specific access. You get the opportunity to ask questions of people that most people don't get, I guess, mm-hmm. these days, unless they've been pre-screened and allowed into one of the town hall meetings. And I think if you take that seriously, mm-hmm. you want to, as my kids would say, use that power for good and not for evil. Mm-hmm. I mean, you want to not waste, for example, not waste a presidential press conference question with a silly question, mm-hmm. Or a question that's going to be easily swatted away mm-hmm. by a president. And you want to, I guess, in the olden days, I guess before 24/7 CNN, you really were people's eyes and ears. But mm-hmm. now I guess I think as a print reporter at the White House or anywhere else, what you can give is sort of not the visual picture, but the kind of internal picture of decision making or what people are like. Or, I mean, for example, you mentioned Andy Card. We had a magnificent profile in the Style section written by Mark Leibovich of Andy Card and how he has this very, how he doesn't take any notes, but he has this complicated memory system that mm-hmm. was just fascinating. Absolutely could not have been done on television. Completely yeah. added to your understanding of Andy Card. And, did Mark think he was a surrogate for the people? I think he probably just thought he had a really interesting profile that he had right. to write.
Yeah, that's true. Do you have a question? Sure.
Yeah. What is the good part or advantage of working at Washington Post or being a Washington Post writer, which is the most read newspaper in Washington, D.C.?
The advantage is that it's the most read newspaper in Washington, D.C., and, sometimes that makes people responsive to you. Sometimes that makes people hostile to you. You know that whatever you write, you're going to be called to account for it. If people disagree with it, you're going to hear it. If there's something wrong, you're for sure going to hear it. It's great. I also have I've been at the Post for 20 years plus, so I'm kind of a lifer. I just have, a newsroom full of colleagues who are all really smart and really good at what they do and kind of willing to share information with me. But I think, it's great to work for the paper that ends up on your friends' doorsteps every morning. And I think it would be probably frustrating to work for a paper and write things and not have kind of people immediately there having read it.
Mm-hmm. Has technology made a difference there? Has it been easier for people? I can remember talking to a reporter who worked for a regional paper, and he had an article that that he thought really broke ground. It was on Nixon. And so what he ended up doing to get it read was he had somebody on another newspaper ask that it be put on the wire. Mm-hmm. And so it ended up moving. Uh-huh. But he had to go to that extent, whereas today it seems you don't have to do that kind of thing.
It's unbelievable. When I write a column with my name signed, so I get a lot of, when we put our emails at the bottom, and I get email starting the night before because it goes up on the web, not just from all around the country, but sometimes from all around the world. Uh-huh. And so it's actually, sure. It's certainly helped the regional papers and the smaller papers, especially because they're now synopsized by the hotlines and the early mm-hmm. birds and the notes and the things like that. And it's helped us become more of a national presence as opposed to, or an international presence as opposed to just a Washington paper. I think technology, I'm sure this is true of every occupation to some extent, but it has so transformed my life as a reporter you know, starting from my first reporting job, which was in 1979, till now. It's just night and day. I was, you know, things that you used to have to sort of get up and go to the Library of Congress to go read, or go to the Federal Election Commission to dig up and go through the microfiche. You can, you know, sit at your kitchen table with your laptop and pull it up in no time at all. And I just think that's phenomenal for our access to information.
What about the tools that we now have to pry information out? Are they better than when you first started, like, say, FOIA? Or is it work pretty much the same?
Difficult? I think that's still difficult. It's probably harder now than it was, but I think that the information that is public is that was technically public 20 years ago. That was public if you sort of got up and took the time to go get it, which it wasn't always possible to do on deadline. Now is available pretty much at the click of a mouse. And that's pretty extraordinary. The downside to it is the sort of thing I was joking about before, about covering the White House, you know, from your bedroom in your pajamas, is it is very important to get out and see and feel and hear things. And, I mean, I find this as an editorial writer. I did some campaign travel during the last election, and that didn't help me write issues pieces, but it did help me understand the candidates and how people, both talking to voters and seeing them with voters, to understand what they were like and how they responded to people. And I think that the sort of downside of technology is enabling us to, enabling some degree of laziness, and we all need to guard against that. And, you know, you can flick on the hearing and watch it in your office in streaming video, but that doesn't give you the same sense of being in the hearing room for a really charged hearing.
That's certainly true with the White House, at least in the afternoon, with the afternoon briefing. So there is a lot more that's on the record. On the other hand, with the briefing, since it is televised, there is certainly no off the record or on background. The Post has, over the years, fought a big battle over background. Can you tell us something about it?
Well, we have these, I would call them kind of waves of intensity. We all, since I've been there, which has been since 1984, we've all said two things that haven't really worked. One is that we're going to have shorter stories. And which we never do, actually. And the other is that we're going to, you know, do our best to stop using anonymous sources. And we do our best to stop using anonymous sources. But there is also a limit to that. And if you completely, there are many, many times when you should say to a person, look, if you want this to be quoted in the paper, you're going to need to attach your name to it. Because a lot of times you see, you know, completely innocuous quotes from administration officials that they ought to be able to attach their name to. It's also problematic to quote people anonymously who are saying nasty things. There are also times when if you went cold turkey and didn't have anonymous sources, you would completely not have as good a story, as accurate a story, as fair a story, as complete a story for your reader. And so, you know, you can argue that it's unfair to ask readers to rely on their trust in you, to believe in your anonymous sources, but I also feel really strongly that if you outlawed anonymous sources, you'd be depriving your readers of something also. Well, the newsroom, and I have to say I feel somewhat relieved that I haven't been part of this process, has now been engaging in, and I think the New York Times has been doing this also, an effort to explain the reasons that the sources demanded anonymity, and it's, you know, sometimes they can be pretty funny, you know, because they're not authorized, because they're afraid they're going to get, because they're going to get in trouble, for God's sakes, with somebody if we're telling the truth. One of the actually liberating things about writing editorials is that even though I actually do use a lot of quotes, as we were talking about before, you're much freer to talk to people because quotes aren't a necessary piece of what you're doing. You can just say, look, talk to me. It's totally off the record. I just want to understand what you're doing, why you're doing it, what you think the prospects are, where you think the votes are, and everything else. And it is, and so you're not engaging in the downside of the anonymous source transaction, which is that you're quoting somebody and asking your reader to trust you, that you're not inventing it, that you're reflecting it fairly, but you're getting the benefit of the anonymous source transaction, which is that the giving somebody the freedom to speak to you more freely gets you a more informed perspective.
In the separation that exists between the editorial operation and the news operation, what are all the ways in which they're separate, and what are the ways that they sometimes come together? Because we've seen that there are some times that you come together.
Well, we have some interviews together. We never would meet together absent a public figure. There are times I will ask my colleagues in the newsroom if they have a copy of a certain report, if anything is, if they've written a story, if there's any follow-up that I should know about, if I'm following it up, things like that. There's been a few times that I've had documents that were, you know, that it was appropriate for me to share with them, that they've asked me for, that I've shared with them. You know, they've been my colleagues for 20 years. Right. I still have lunch with them.
Yeah. Okay. Another question? Towson?
I would agree with your characterization about the Post's web or the editorial pages being not liberal or neutral. And I was wondering, is that a philosophy that you have as editorial page writers, or does it have something to do with the selection of the people who compose the editorial board?
I think it probably has something to do with the selection of the people who compose the editorial board, and in particular the selection of the editorial page editor. And if you look at our masthead above the editorials, it says the Washington Post, an independent paper, and I think that's what we really pride ourselves on being, that, you know, if you work for an editorial page that is relentlessly conservative, you know where you're going to come out on any number of issues. If you work for an editorial page that is relentlessly liberal, you know where you're going to come out on any number of issues. On our editorial page, you don't actually always know where you're going to come out. I mean, we do have very strongly held views on a number of topics, and there is an importance to precedent in editorials. You don't want to sort of all of a sudden reverse our position on the wisdom of the Bush administration's tax cuts or something like that, or whether there should be drilling in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. But if you're looking at an issue fresh, you want to look at it and hear the arguments from one side and hear the arguments from the other side, and hopefully just think clearly about who has the better of, I mean, this may sound like awfully kind of goo-goo and airy-fairy, but who has the better of the argument on this issue in the framework of the way we all look at the world, which is, you know, we're not, there's seven or eight of us, we're on a spectrum from of political viewpoints, but none of us are kind of doctrinally hidebound to our particular point of view, nor do any of us kind of feel like we're on one team or the other team.
Any other questions? Do you have another? Okay.
I heard that the number of the people who subscribe newspaper is decreasing. Is that right?
Yeah, our circulation is falling.
Okay. And so that means more and more people are reading it on internet, online.
Well, one of two things is happening. Clearly more people are reading it online, and this is not just true of the Post, it's just true of all newspapers. Circulation has been falling, and fewer people are reading newspapers in any form, electronic or ink on paper.
What do you think the future of the newspaper?
Well,
going to be different, or I'm sure that it's not going to disappear, but
I hope it's not going to disappear. I don't know. I take a lot of pleasure in seeing my 9-year-old come down to breakfast in the morning and ask for the Kids Post. And so I think that there's a lot of different ways in which people can get information in the modern world, and that's terrific and appropriate, and people are going to get their newspaper information differently, and they're going to get it in different modes, and hopefully there will continue to be a dedicated enough core of people who can't get all the information they want the way they want it from just television or just radio or just non-newspaper websites, that there will still be a role for us for many years in this kind of new techno environment.
How do you think newspapers can make the internet profitable for them?
This is the sort of more than $64 million question for all of us. The Post website, which I'm not an expert at talking about, but has started to turn a small profit. As advertisers, I think we know the way in which newspapers can't make the websites profitable for them, which is to charge money. That has not been a model that's worked for anybody except for the Wall Street Journal.
Right.
I find as I sort of go to different newspapers around the country, even having to register in a detailed way turns me off from certain papers. I'm just not going to. Even privacy questions aside, I'm just not going to take the time to get all that information to get to your site.
And then part of it's true is trying to remember the password.
Yeah.
If you don't go into it for a week, then what's your password? And then, and then they won't let you in because they actually have your email address, but you don't have the password, so you can't register new. Yeah.
Advertisers and our web folks alike are trying to figure out what advertising is profitable and makes sense on the web versus other forms. I think the thing that's terrific about newspaper websites is the ability to get kind of value-added journalism, which is not just what's in the paper, but also click and you can get the underlying document. You can read it for yourself if you want. Or click and you can get access to an online discussion about the issue and things like that. And I think as more people become more comfortable with those various modes and are attracted to the website, hopefully in addition to the newspaper, for that reason, more advertisers will come to it and we'll all get paid more.
but work harder, too, because then they have to put stories out during the day. So people, instead of just writing, one story, then they're having to generate news during the day, write stories about what's happening.
Yeah. That's a complication.
Yeah.
And I think we've all adjusted to. Luckily, we don't have breaking editorials.
Yeah. Well, that's true even with television. Mm-hmm. That used to be, you know, there was just network news. And so the presence of cable has certainly right. changed their operations as well. So it's a long day. When you were covering the White House, what did your day run from?
Well, it ran from early in the morning till late at night. And a lot of, you know, if you were traveling, a lot of times you had to be at Andrews yeah. at some horrible right. hour, like 5 o'clock in the morning. A lot of times your phone would ring at 10:30 or 11 o'clock at night. The New York Times has blah, blah, blah. The LA Times has blah, blah, blah. Can you match it? What do you know about it? And sort of, you know, get up and go deal with whatever the crisis of the day was. And at the White House, a lot of times you are not getting your calls back until 6:30, 7:30 at night. And so you might have been kind of twiddling your thumbs for some period in the afternoon when they were all in meetings and not calling you back. And then all of a sudden, you'll be scrambling to write your story at a time that I'm now comfortably home on the editorial right. page between 7:30 and 8:30. And then you'll be, because we have a number of editions during the night, and then you can be updating it and adding to it. Mm-hmm. And it was a long, long day, a lot of days. But, you know, but luckily at a paper like The Post, there's more than one person to do that. And so you share that burden. So it's not every single day.
Yeah. Any other questions, Towson? Okay, none? Okay, well, thank you very much, Ruth.
Thank you, it was fun.
Yeah, enjoyed it very much. Thanks.